Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to the 9th series of Reading Our Times. In this series, we're navigating our way through a world of confusing and often contentious ideas, equipped only with big books, serious authors, and time to think. We're going to be talking about slavery and reparations, wokery and left-wing politics, poetry and our sense of the sacred. We're going to talk about the origins of the West, what's behind the assisted dying debate, about the way the Enlightenment has been co-opted into the culture wars, about how our evolutionary past continues to shape our political present, and in a live recording at the How the Light Gets In Festival in London, I'll be talking to critics and publishers about books and the future of civilization. And underneath it all, of course, lies the question to which Reading Our Times always gravitates. What does all this say about the human condition? There's just a small chance you stumbled across the little word woke. And there's just a small chance you have an opinion about woke. Depending on who you are, what you believe, and very probably how young or old you are, you might well understand woke as meaning concerned with fundamental human justice or with the rights of minorities or perhaps with simple, basic human courtesy and kindness. Alternatively, you might just understand it to mean obsessed with identity politics, tribal, angry, inclined to cancel voices with which we disagree, perhaps even fundamentally unkind. Whatever view you do hold, you probably associate the term with the left. Lefty and liberal are the words most commonly paired with woke. And after all, it's the right that is locked into a culture war with woke. The left have no problem with it, surely. They are fellow travellers, at least. More likely, the same people. But what if that isn't the case? What if it's an oversimplification? A category error? A case of mistaken identity? What if woke isn't left, and left isn't woke? Where does that leave the left? And where does it leave wokery? Susan Nyman is a moral philosopher, cultural commentator, and director of the Einstein Forum in Germany. She's written books on moral philosophy, politics, the Enlightenment, and her latest book, Left is Not Woke, explores the meaning of this modern movement, and in particular, the associations it has with left-wing politics. I spoke to Susan a few days ago. Susan, welcome to Reading Our Times.
Thank you, Nick. Glad to be here.
Let's begin with the origins of the word woke. When was it first used to mean roughly what we use it to mean today?
So it was first used by the great American blues singer Lead Belly in 1938. And he was writing about the Scottsboro Boys. The so-called Scottsboro Boys were 9 black teenagers who were falsely accused of raping 2 white women. And only an international campaign on their behalf prevented them from being executed. Lead Belly wrote a song about them saying, "Stay woke." And that meant stay conscious of racism, watch out for it. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, on the contrary, there's a lot that's right for that. The word woke really came into common use about 2017. It played no role in the American election of 2016, did not come up once. And it seemed to me, and as to many people, it was actually a good word. It was something that one could embrace because the word left had become so unclear and progressive is also quite vague. So I thought 2017, 2018, maybe woke is really a good word. It's got a ring to it. There's something slightly cool or even erotic about it. So it was very interesting to me that about 2020, 2021, when I started thinking about some of the issues that led to this book, that I realized, no, it's turned sour.
Yes.
And dogmatic in a very problematic way.
Do you have any idea of why it emerged in 2017? Well, I know obviously there's a lot of populism and fear about nationalism at the time, but it seems to me strange that a word that has lying dormant really for three generations is suddenly seized upon and goes mainstream incredibly quickly. Do you know why that happened?
Look, my guess is this. It did start in the States. 2017, we saw the backlash to President Obama lead to Donald Trump's taking over. One can say there's a lot of factors in that election, but nobody doubts that it was fueled by resentment at the fact that this highly successful, highly intelligent, good-looking, cool Black family had been living in the White House for 8 years and done it with a grace and dignity that all of the people behind Donald Trump, and of course Donald Trump himself, could never have pulled off. And just sheer resentment. And all of a sudden you have going back to a period where claims against very basic racism made sense. That makes perfect sense to me in the US.
So let's explore what happened then, because the word, as you say, originally means staying alert to injustice, particularly injustice around race. That's how it's resurrected in 2017 or so. That is transparently a good objective. And many people today will insist that wokeism, if that's the right noun, is around the concern for marginalized people and the recognition that there are silent power norms at play. We're going to touch on power a bit later in our conversation. But I'm interested to know, when do you think, in your mind, problems emerge? And what is the main underlying problem with it?
So I started to feel problems emerging in the fall of 2020, which was a very important moment when what had been a quite international response to the murder of George Floyd turned into something that was divided into people who were really demonstrating on behalf of George Floyd and against police violence, and people who were allies. Okay. It did not start out that way at all. More people who identified as white were on the streets demonstrating in June of 2020 than people of color. It's really hard to know which came first, but whether it was the rights charge that this is something that's only of concern to Black people, or various people who had organized Black Lives Matter saying, well, actually, this is mainly of concern to Black people. We don't want any so-called white saviors, but we allow that white people can be allies. Mm. And as soon as you do that, you destroy genuine solidarity, which has always been part of the left, okay? It has always been part of the left to say you can have genuine relationships with, and therefore genuine obligations to, people who are not part of your tribe. And it's always been part of the right to say, not really. You can really only connect with people who come from your tribe, and therefore you don't have any particular obligations towards them either. So that was the point, the fall of 2020, when I started worrying about this and saying, this is going in a funny direction. A few months ago, we had this very universalist impulse to stand up against police violence against people of color, and it's fracturing in weird ways.
Well, I want to emphasize that point, because that's the subject of your first chapter, and I think it's an absolutely critical one, that what happens in, you're dating it around 2020, is a slide from solidarity to tribalism, effectively, a slide from a movement that is intentionally universalistic, that unites people over a cause, to one that actually divides them over the same cause, right?
Exactly.
Is it just you? Are you a voice crying in the wilderness here? Do other people detect the way in which the woke movement has drifted away from some of the left's core concerns?
I wrote this book because I was having conversations with friends in a number of countries and of different ages as well. And, you know, I'd be sitting in a cafe or something, and a friend of mine who had been really part of the activist left their whole life would say, I think I'm not left anymore. I don't like what's going on. And I wrote this book to say out loud and to try and articulate what the problems were. Everybody I knew was saying in private. Yeah, a lot of people have come up to me and said that I was articulating and explaining what people were saying in private. So, no, I'm not crying in the wilderness. I hope that I'm doing something that's picking up steam, actually.
Well, let me push back slightly on the claim of left universalism. I absolutely understand the point you're making there. But how do you respond to someone who said, well, that's more in theory than in reality? The left certainly is solidaristic in principle, but actually it has engaged in class war in the past. Its solidarity is primarily directed at those who share an economic interest. And in that regard, that it's not quite as universalistic as all that.
Well, the interesting thing is, look at that reproach or that criticism. It isn't saying we think universalism is a bad thing. We're saying it needs to be recognized more clearly. And I quote the French author and filmmaker, Rocaille Diablo, who, you know, France is a slightly different case than other places just because they think they invented universalism. I guess they sort of did. And that's a country in which the right has so cathected onto the idea of universalism that they refuse to recognize difference. And Rocaille read the book, and I asked her to look at the book because it's coming out in France. And I know the discussion is a little bit different there, and I wanted to make sure that I accounted for it. And her take was, I have absolutely nothing against universalism. I just wish that it would be genuinely realized. And I think that every advance that we make in demanding rights for marginalized groups can only be made with universalist premises.
So it's predicated on the idea that we are fundamentally equal in dignity, equal in worth, and therefore we merit the same treatment, the same rights socially.
Exactly.
One of your criticisms of, I don't like the word wokery because sometimes it's used in quite a loose way, but for the sake of argument, one of the criticisms you level at wokery is that it reduces individuals to what you call the prism of marginalisation, or it reduces them to their victimhood. Now, explain what you mean by that, because that's a very important concept.
It is. But before I go into that, let me suggest that there's a reason why it's used in a vague way and nobody really knows how to use it. It is not a coherent concept. Most political concepts have various components. One set of components are emotional and the other are intellectual. Woke is genuinely fueled by left-wing emotions. You want to stand on the side of the oppressed. You want to stand up for people who are marginalized. You want to right the wrongs of history. And all of those are things that fuel the woke and are certainly emotions that I share and, you know, I've shared all my life. But what the woke don't understand often is that they're actually supported by some very reactionary ideas. So the book tries to show how those ideas get misused quite against the intentions of most of the people who are woke and who are drawn to it by these emotional resonances. So I don't use the word identity politics because I think it begs the question that it's meant to answer. Namely, it suggests that our identities are determined by two factors that we have no control over. One is our ethnic identity, ethnic background, and the other is our biological sex. Now, interestingly enough, those are the two facets of our identities that we have absolutely no control over. And they are the two axes on which we're most vulnerable. Okay, we are vulnerable to racism and to sexism. But to suggest that our very complex identities can be reduced to those two strikes me as quite mad, frankly.
And it essentializes people, yes. It says all I am resides in this particular unchosen identity.
Correct, correct. And, you know, everybody knows from their normal lives, if you're applying for a job or filling out a dating profile or anything like that, it would seem ridiculous and reductive and self-defeating to see your entire identity as that. And particularly since those are, as I said, the things that we don't choose, the ways in which we're passive. So normally when we introduce ourselves to people, we want to talk about the things that we have chosen, the profession or the ideas or the political convictions or whatever it is, all of their 10 or 12 or 15 different factors that say more about you than your ethnic and sexual identity.
So part of the challenge, part of the objection you have then is that it is essentializing human identities that are protean and plural and fluid. But it's actually a criticism that goes beyond that, isn't it? Because it's not simply that woke essentializes these identities, but it places a particular value on those identities as marginal identities or as victim identities. And you quote a very powerful and very challenging quote at one point. I think it's from Jean Emery, who was an Auschwitz survivor, who said, to be a victim alone is not an honour. Undergoing suffering isn't a virtue at all, and it rarely creates any. Now, that quote shook me by the lapels a bit, as I think it might do quite a few people. And as I understand it, your objection is not simply that we're essentializing these identities, but some of these identities are treated as virtues simply by dint of the fact they have been marginal or have been victimized.
That is absolutely correct. The idea that you should be valued for what you do in the world rather than what the world does to you. It's become an old-fashioned idea, but it's one that I think we need to return to in certain ways. Another thing that I say in the book, the wonderful civil rights leader and fighter against the death penalty, Bryan Stevenson, says when he's acting on behalf of people who've been sentenced to death, everyone is more than the worst thing that they've ever done. I think that's right. But then it's odd to realize that people are being defined by the worst thing that ever happened to them. That is, by, you know, some experience of racism or sexism, which I'm not saying we should forget about it. I'm just saying that should not be the sole source of authority for anybody, for anything.
And so one of the criticisms that then builds on that is that this whole approach evacuates people of agency. It reduces their own capacity to inform and shape and direct their own existence. Because if your existence is defined by the things that happened to you and indeed the worst thing that happened to you, there's not much you can do about it.
Exactly. And that's the problem with the notion of intersectionality, which when I first heard of, I thought, oh, finally, there's somebody who recognizes that we have more than one identity. But the more I read about intersectionality, the more that became clear to me that intersectionality just means the multiple ways in which you can be a victim. And that's a very impoverished form of identity.
Now, there's a great deal in the book looking at the intellectual roots of woke. These are roots that massively predate the modern use of the word. And one figure is a major thinker in this area, Michel Foucault. And in particular, with regard to your second major point about why the left and the woke are not comfortable bedfellows, it's in the issue of power. Now, the critique that underlies woke is a challenging of power structures that are often invisible to our casual glance. And for that, we do have Foucault to thank, right?
Yes and no. I mean, look, Marx gave us some pretty useful ways of criticizing underlying power structures that, without going into the kind of nihilism that I think Foucault ends in, but okay, let's say that Foucault brought the systematic hidden power structures more to consciousness, perhaps. I'm not sure. I was trying
to be as fair as I possibly could, but
I'm just wondering, actually, it's an interesting question which I haven't thought about. Does Foucault add anything that we couldn't have learned from Marx without the nihilism? And I'm not sure.
And the nihilism is important. You quote Chomsky at one point saying that Foucault was the most amoral man he'd ever met, which is a damning indictment if ever I heard one. This is a really important point, isn't it? Because if you read power into any claims of justice, you're not left with justice anymore, are you?
No, you have no sense of justice whatsoever. You simply have different tribes fighting over power. And that is a Foucauldian notion. It's also, strangely enough, one that would have been very congenial to Carl Schmitt, a Nazi legal philosopher who was weirdly picked up at the turn of the last century and is still taken quite seriously by a number of people who consider themselves to be on the left, because they like his interrogation of liberal hypocrisy. And of course, there's absolutely no question that, let's say, colonial claims to be carrying the white man's burden and bringing truth and goodness to the natives is a piece of offensive bullshit, frankly, okay? I mean, that's a way of cloaking self-serving interests in nice rhetoric to make it seem more palatable. But that's something that's been noticed since the pre-Socratic. You know, most wars and all kinds of political movements cloak themselves in nice sounding rhetoric to make it sound as if people aren't acting for their own interests of power. But the fact that that is sometimes abused doesn't mean that there is no such thing as justice, okay? That's the conclusion that many of the woke have come to.
That's the critical point, isn't it? It's one thing uncovering unjust power ploys beneath certain claims for justice. It's another thing uncovering every claim of justice as simply being a power ploy. Because if you do that, I mean, there is no progress. This is what's so fascinating about this. This is a thinker that's often celebrated by the progressive left, but it seems to be a thinker who massively undermines the idea that there can be such an idea of progress because all claims to justice are simply power struggles.
Well, absolutely. And because he's quite brilliant in suggesting that what you thought was progress was actually a more subtle form of repression, as in his most famous book, probably, Discipline and Punish, which leaves you thinking that it would be better to be drawn and quartered than it would be to be stuck in Jeremy Bentham's prism. And of course, Foucault and Foucauldians don't like making normative claims. So they think it would be tacky to say, well, X is better than Y. But that is the impression that one is left with after reading a great deal of Foucault.
There's a very interesting intellectual parallel with what we've been talking about in terms of Foucault and the discovery of power in all claims of justice, which you mention in this chapter, which is from sociobiology and evolutionary psychology. And this is a movement which is now, I guess, 50 or so years old, really, since Wilson's famous book in the early 70s, where inclination to locate virtually all human behaviour in basically what went on in the Paleolithic, in our evolutionary past. But more than that, to use it to unmask any claims that we might have towards human goodness, let alone altruism, and show that actually we are just selfish machines and we're programmed to reproduce and we might favour some kind of reciprocal altruism at best, but actually any deep fundamental human good is simply an illusion foisted on us by our genes. And that's a curious kind of intellectual ally for those who want to undermine any sense of justice and progress, isn't it?
It is. And the more I think about it, the more I think evolutionary psychology is the broadest ideology that we have going on today. And it's, of course, not thought of as an ideology. It's thought of as science. And as science, it's accepted by people on the left and on the right and everybody in between. We are told that evolutionary biologists following Darwin have simply determined that this is how the world is. And anybody who questions it is like one of those creationists who believes that the world was created in 7 days. Note, I'm not questioning Darwin. This is not Darwin, evolutionary psychology. And I think it's really interesting. You're right that it started as sociobiology with Wilson and the sociobiologists in the 70s and 80s. It then died down. And it was reinvented in the late 90s, not as sociobiology, but as evolutionary psychology, because sociobiology had been so thoroughly attacked in the 70s and 80s as quite reactionary, racist, and sexist. But at the same moment when neoliberalism was gathering full steam, that is the idea that this was the end of history and the only thing that we're really only motivated to do is compete with each other for power and money, along comes this ideology that is absolutely made to convince us that, this is really all that motivates us. Mm. And anything that claims to be more deeply social, more deeply interested in the common good is all fluff. As this evolutionary psychologists say, the problem of altruism. We have to solve the problem of altruism because it doesn't really fit the theory.
I've just finished reviewing a book, and it's a very intelligent book. It's about economics and religion, but repeatedly it reaches back into the Paleolithic for explanations for our current behavior. Like you, I'm a fully paid up Darwinian, and it'd be absurd to say that our minds haven't been influenced by millions of years of evolution in the same way as our bodies have been. But what strikes me as being particularly pernicious about that is this. Foucault says this, and you and I can turn around and say, but I disagree with Foucault, so I don't find these arguments persuasive. An evolutionary psychologist says this, and you're moved into the position whereby you're apparently disagreeing with science or disagreeing with the facts. And you make a point in the book that this isn't a weird area where the alleged fact-value distinction seems to be alive and well, and people are stating facts or stating what they think are facts without recognising that there are very significant value judgments and framings that are imported into this dialogue.
You know, that was recognized by Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the mid-18th century when you weren't talking about evolution, but you were talking about people's speculations about the state of nature. What's nature and what's nurture in us? What can be changed? What's fixed or hardwired, as we would say today? So it's natural that people speculate about how people were before civilization. But it was Rousseau who noticed, you know, we cannot get access to that. And every attempt that we make to describe how people were in the state of nature is completely colored by our views. So Hobbes, for example, wants to establish an authoritarian ruler. And he claims, well, in the state of nature, life was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Everybody would kill each other if there weren't a strong ruler. And Rousseau is often wrongly claimed as saying, oh, well, everything was beautiful in the state of nature. He doesn't say that. He says, we can't know. We have no access. So evolutionary psychology comes along and says, well, this is what drove our hunter-gatherer ancestors 200,000 years ago. And you say, wait, what evidence do we have about people 200,000 years ago? Actually, we're talking about pre-literate humankind. No written records.
We've been doing too much agreeing in this conversation. Let me push back on one particular area of the book, and actually on a word you use then, which is enlightenment. Now, to my mind, you are entirely right to defend the Enlightenment against those critics you mentioned who effectively lay at the door of the Enlightenment, Holocaust and totalitarian states. But I cavilled a bit at one point you wrote in your book, the Enlightenment introduced the very idea of humanity. I've done some work on the influence of Christian thought in Western mind. There's a degree of universalism that's rooted in the Hebrew scriptures. There are medieval scholastics worked out some really quite sophisticated ideas about the rights due to persons. The rule of law, was present in certain nascent way in certain European jurisdictions from as early as the 13th century. And there were Christian political theorists who were developing ideas of political resistance in the 16th century on the back of the Reformation. So I just wanted to push back on the idea that so much of what you laud does have its roots in the Enlightenment. I'm not denying the Enlightenment's significance, but it seems to me that it was drawing on earlier traditions that themselves are rooted in Christendom.
Well, you know, then we can argue, is it Christendom? Is it Judaism? There are good arguments for its being in Judaism. There is at least one Indian tradition, which is very universalistic. There's some African traditions. So sure, what the Enlightenment did, however, was to give us a set of principles that were independent of what your religious belief was, that was accessible to anybody in all of those different traditions simply through the use of reason and not requiring faith in a particular tradition. Okay. But in addition to Foucault, I think today the people who are most critical of the Enlightenment, not even critical, dismissive of the Enlightenment, are people working in post-colonial theory who argue that the Enlightenment invented notions of universality that were entirely Eurocentric and reproducing the interests of basically white European men in order to dominate others. I try to show in the book that that's nonsense, frankly. It just is not true to what the Enlightenment was doing. I don't disagree with you in saying that there are elements of universalism in a whole bunch of different traditions, but that it's important now to revalue the Enlightenment tradition because of the almost incessant attacks on it that involve not just giving up notions of universality, but also giving up notions of reason and argument, which I think are terribly important to defend.
I want us to return to Woke, and a question that I'm sure will have crossed your mind when writing the book. You put forward a number of very cogent and well-argued critiques of the idea that Woke is synonymous with left. Presumably, when writing this, though, you had at the back of your mind the concern that this might simply be giving ammunition to those on the right, those whom you would not want to associate yourself with, to attack Woke. To what extent are you worried that those with whom you are most definitely not political bedfellows will appropriate some of the arguments?
Not at all, actually. Because the book's been around in several countries for a while, and it simply hasn't happened. It was a worry at the beginning, and I did several things to try and assuage that fear. One is to say on page one of the book that I'm a socialist, and that does kind of,
you paint your colors to the mast straight ahead.
Yeah, exactly. That should stop a lot of right-wing people in their tracks. I had friends who told me, I basically agree with your arguments, but please don't use the word woke. It will be instrumentalized by the right. My French publisher didn't even want to publish it for that reason. Now I have a new and bigger French publisher. So I'm okay with that.
My last question. Reading Our Times is a great opportunity to talk to great authors about fantastic books on interesting subjects. And underlying all this, we have a running question. What does what we've been talking about say about the human condition? What light does it shed on the kind of creatures or the kind of persons we are? What would your answer to that question be?
Oh, boy.
Sorry to spring that one on you.
Yeah, that's a big question. It's a good one, though. So I think we are creatures who are caught between our sense of the way the world is and our sense of the way the world ought to be. And I believe that being a grown-up or a good citizen or a person who's alive in the right sort of way depends on staying alive to both of those things and trying to balance. And it's awfully hard to balance, okay? It's much, much easier simply to focus on the way things are and to become cynical or nihilistic and say, yeah, you know, you can think about, have some pipe dreams about the way the world ought to be, but it's never going to happen. And it's, you know, never happened before. You can also go in the other direction. You can focus on the way the world ought to be without keeping yourself grounded in an understanding of the way things are. But I think that it's both a metaphysical and a psychological fact about us that we ought to balance between those two poles, recognizing how hard it is to do. I mean, and I think that what I've been saying about the woke are, in all of the ways that I think they've bought into reactionary ideas, involve a kind of resignation. That is, it is easier, usually, to connect with people who are part of your tribe, to recognize the humanity in somebody who gets your jokes and gets your allusions and, you know, where you have a sort of automatic connection. It is harder to connect with someone from a very different background, okay? And so I suppose it's easy to give up on trying to make that connection and to stay tribal. Same thing goes with, you know, trying to maintain a distinction between power and justice. It's easier to say, you know, there have been so many times when claims of justice masked claims to power that I'm not even going to try to figure them out. And the same thing goes with claims to progress. I think it's way easier, and this is my problem with a lot of the symbolic political activism among the woke. It is symbolic, and it's much easier to sort of deconstruct than it is actually to try and make some small contribution to, say, holding back the very real danger of fascism on many continents. But that is what we need to do.
The book is called Left is Not Woke. Susan Nyman, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times.
Been a great pleasure, Nick. Thank you for your questions.
Next week, I'll be speaking to the moral theologian Michael Banner about the case for reparations for slavery and colonialism.
I mean, if my great-granddad stole your people's land or property and you'd suffered, of course I shouldn't be punished for that. I didn't do it. But am I not a little bit ashamed? You know, my people did that to your people.
You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Lizzie Harvey, and Ginny MacDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And you can also find us on our website, theosthinktank.co.uk. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. It'll help other people find the podcast.